Welcome to another edition of Hockey the Podcast with me, Derek Albert, and as always, the hostess with the mostess, well, the host with the most, rather. Sorry, Tyron Jabu Bonnard. Tyron, good evening. How are you doing?
Yeah, Derek, good. Thanks. And yourself. It's been a wonderful lockdown for Hockey the Podcast as we've managed to chat to some superb guys and girls in the world of South African hockey, and we're looking forward to adding another one to that list tonight.
Yeah, and this is all you're doing, it has to be said. You realized as soon as this lockdown was upon us, man, this is the time to make while we can, because they don't really have anything else to do, and this is the perfect opportunity to take advantage of that, and that's exactly what we have been doing. So every Thursday night, we've been recording a hell of a lot of podcasts each and every time, and we're sending them out pretty quickly, I must add. And yeah, it's definitely the fastest moving podcast in the Raider Media staple.
Yeah, and look, I mean, obviously, thank you yourself for making the time, and obviously to all the hockey stars who have made time for us. It's been a really great thing listening in the past couple of weeks to the likes of Peter Wright and John T. Robinson and of course, Ian Evans in our most recent episode, just sharing some of the stories and sharing some of the tales. And of course, it was Ian who put us on to tonight's guest.
Yeah, and tell us about tonight's guest. It's a biggie.
Yeah, absolutely. This gentleman is fairly synonymous with the SA Hockey men's team. If you think about him as a player, as a coach, if you Google the team, he's one of the first images that'll come up, and it is none other than Ian Evans' very own hockey playing role model, Greg Clark. Welcome, Clarky.
Hey, Tyron, thanks very much. Thanks, Derek. Really cool to be on the podcast. Thanks for inviting me to chat.
Does it feel like an honor, Greg? I must admit that the last couple of guests we've had, they've really spoken so highly of the fact that they're on the podcast. It makes us feel pretty proud.
No, it is. I mean, it's always cool to still get asked to chat and to share some experiences and knowledge and that type of thing. Yeah, I mean, it's great. Thank you very much. It really is cool to chat.
Well, the honor is all ours, I promise you.
Well, Greg, let's dive in. I mean, I was Derek and myself both managed to watch your interview with Ian Evans on the SA Hockey Legends page, and it was absolutely fantastic. And hearing how you guys could speak quite openly about the coaches and the career that you've had, and I suppose let's get right to the start, supposedly. And I guess the best place to start is, where does the lockdown currently find you? Because obviously, if you Google the name Greg Clark, the word Canada comes up quite a lot.
Yeah, no, I'm currently sitting in Cape Town on the lower slopes of Table Mountain, where I reside. It's my family. So I've been working for Canada for a few years now, but always been based in Cape Town. And I just travel and tour with them. So, yeah, I've been really enjoying the beginning of lockdown, late summer weather. And it's turned to autumn now, but it's still amazing in this country, the weather that we have. And we've been very lucky with the timing of this lockdown that we can be a little bit outdoors still and all that type of stuff. So, yeah, Cape Town is where I am right now.
Fantastic. Let's go back to the playing days before we get into the coaching days. As far as records go, you are South Africa's most capped men's outdoor player. Of course, it is very difficult finding out this information. You played a lot of hockey for South Africa. You played in the Olympic Games. You were twice. You were probably robbed of it on the third time. What stands out for you from that career that you had as a player?
I mean, listen, I'm very fortunate. I played for a long time. I think it was 11 and a half, close to 12 years. So I racked up a fair amount of caps and tours in those days. I think there are a lot of guys that are currently playing now. I mean, obviously, you chatted to Rusty the other day. As a goalkeeper, it's difficult because there's only one spot and there are two keepers on tour. And so generally you have a sort of a bit of an apprenticeship. A guy like Austin Smith's been around a hell of a long time, and all things being equal, if the program had run consistently or over all the years Austin had been playing, he might have overtaken my record by now. So yeah, I was lucky that I played and we had a consistent program, and I did rack up those games. And yeah, it was just, I think I chatted to Ian on his platform the other day, and I just, you know, right place at the right time. I was just sort of starting to get to a really good point in my career, just as South African sport and South African hockey was coming out of isolation. So I was a young gun sort of making those first post-isolation squads, and I got selected for the first team. And yeah, I was, you know, I was lucky. I was a forward at the time, liked to express myself. And I guess they were looking for young guys at that stage who could do that, because we had a lot of experienced guys who were coming out of isolation, hadn't had the chance to participate. And yeah, so I went to the 96 Olympics, which was a massive highlight. But if truth be told, I wasn't a very accomplished international player at the time. Sort of, you know, as the years went on and I got a bit more experience and a bit more exposure and a little bit more worldly wise and mature, sort of turned into a much better player. Missed out on the 98 World Cup, missed out on the 2000 Olympics. The World Cup, we didn't qualify. The Olympics was the political story. And then sort of hung in, went to a World Cup in 2002 and sort of finished my career at the Athens Olympics in 2004. And it was a lot of highlights and one or two lowlights in between, but just an amazing ride as a player. Very fortunate to have played so many games, been on so many tours, been to so many different amazing places and with so many amazing people to share those experiences with.
Greg, I know you briefly touched on it, and I know you've got so many highlights. You've just quickly spoken about all those great memories. But, yeah, we just got to go back to Sydney 2000. I mean, the disappointment of that decision, the political interference, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, listen, I mean, it depends who you chat to about what the reasoning was at the time. Yeah, I mean, it's quite a long involved story whether there's any truth to it or not. But I know that post Atlanta in '96, I know that the SA hockey president at the time, I think, was a guy called Steve Jaspan, and I think he had lobbied quite hard with Sam Ramsamy to get one of the hockey teams to go. I think the men got the nod. I can't remember if the ladies had qualified for that games as well. But he really, yeah, sort of had to beg and plead for this team to go to the Atlanta games. And on the basis of that, I think he lobbied against Ramsamy in the cycle post Atlanta. And this is the, I mean, I may be way off the mark here, but this is the story that I understand. And at the next sort of election, to elect a president in or out of SASCOC, I think that Sam Ramsamy prevailed by a very short margin. But because of all the lobbying that Steve Jaspan had been doing behind the scenes against Sam Ramsamy, I believe that in Sydney it was a little bit of payback to hockey as a sport. Maybe it was a bit of a personal thing that came out on a bigger thing. But if it's not the exact reason, I know that perhaps it was a contributing factor for that. I know there were other political things in terms of the sort of racial makeup of the team and what hockey was doing. I do know that hockey had quite a good track record throughout the years in terms of the grassroots stuff and stuff we were doing. But yeah, that's the sort of picture I understand what kind of transpired there.
Yeah, Greg, and of course, just switching quickly gears from playing to coaching, you then dealt with a pretty similar thing in 2012, where you were the coach of the national team and you qualified for the Olympic Games, but you were forced to go qualify for a second time. Fortunately, that probably brought us one of the highlights of many of those players' careers in that Olympic qualifying tournament.
Yeah, I mean, it, I think, you know, Ian Evans chatted to Bruce Jakes earlier today on that Instagram platform, and I think Jakes touched on it, and he said that, you know, if we hadn't had to, we didn't qualify in 2003 because we, you know, we really butchered it right in the back end of the game. We lost to Egypt, and we had to go through a different the World Qualification Tournament, which was in Madrid in 2004. And actually, he said it made us stronger because, you know, we had to really raise the bar and we had to go and qualify on a very difficult level. And so in 2012, when we did that, it was disappointing and difficult, having sort of had the goalposts shifted, so to speak, because we had to go to Japan. But ultimately, what it did was, you know, in terms of our program and the timing of that tournament, if I'm not mistaken, it was about April, May of that year. And so with the Olympics, you know, in July, August, it kind of puts you in quite a good space. You're having to peak in May. Once you qualify, and we did qualify for the 2012, then you can go away, sort of put a bit of fine tuning and a bit of polish on, and then go to the Olympics a couple of months later. So whilst it was incredibly difficult and like I say, shifted the goalposts, and you know, the players really had to come with a different mindset. Like you say, it gelled the team. It gave us an opportunity to play in a really tough tournament in another sort of uncompromising environment, and coming out on top just really galvanized us. And we actually came very close to having a very, very good Olympic Games.
Yeah, and well, that's naturally where the progression would go to. Obviously, we had beat Japan 2-1, and we go to the Olympic Games, and of course, we play against the incredible Australians in the opening game, and we keep them down to an okay score, but it wasn't a great start. And then all of a sudden, everything just seemed to click, and somehow we walked away from the Great Britain game with just a draw after dominating it. Pakistan game, after being fantastic, we lost 5-4 with two late goals. And, you know, and the story will always be that we finished in the 11th place. But just how close for you were we from making it through to that top eight?
Yeah, I mean, I probably haven't gone back and watched one or two of those games just because it's just so hard at the time. You know, we really had done incredibly well as a team, as a group. After quite a disappointing Beijing in 2008, not just in terms of where we finished, but also performances weren't great. It was a difficult Olympic Games on so many different levels. And then, I've actually got a pretty poor record against Australia in my time. I probably try and play too much hockey against them, and they come out and punish me. But so, you know, that Aussie game, I wasn't really... You know, it's quite nice to come up against them in the first game of tournaments, because often they're coming a little bit cold and they look to peak at the back end of the tournaments. So I thought we could sort of have a dip at them, but it didn't work out. And then, yeah, we'd played GB three times already. They came to South Africa for a training camp in the January, February of 2012. And we won one, we drew one, and we lost one. So we were level pegging with them going into that game in London. And yeah, I really thought that we could beat them any time we went and faced them. Really contentious equaliser, the Ashley Jackson goal, which we referred. It was inconclusive, and as a result, the umpire's on-field decision of the goal stood. But it was just a really dodgy goal, in my opinion. So many question marks around it, and then. Yeah, Pakistan, I think we led four times and lost that game. Argentina, we were 2-0 up after 6 minutes and we lost 6-4. And Spain, I think we went down 2-1, and again, a very competitive game. So many small little moments, which, you know, in international sport, in top sport, the line is very fine. But we came very close, like I say. It could have been such a successful game for us, bar one or two small moments.
Greg, you say that you don't have a very good record against the Aussies. Geez, I think you're in very good company across all sporting codes. Many people have uttered those words before.
Yeah, listen, I mean, they're a phenomenal team, and also during that era, you know, sort of they won the 2010 World Cup, they won the 2014 World Cup. So, yeah, they were a pretty handy team at that stage. And so, yeah, to come up against them in the first game of Olympics is always difficult. Yeah, but again, I'm not sure I really expressed it too much to the players, but I wasn't really looking at anything we got out of that game was a bonus.
Gareth Ewing, the current men's coach, is a very good friend of the show. And he said, having taken over the role for the first time, he was not surprised, but he expected a lot of prep. But I mean, there is a hell of a lot of work that goes involved, as we expect it to be in any coaching position, particularly when you're coaching a country across any sporting code. Yeah, 2012 was where you decided to call it a day. Had you had enough?
To be honest, I was actually playing some of the best hockey of my life at the, in those sort of 2003-2004 tournaments. I had a little bit of a disappointing Olympics in Athens. I'd had some really good tournaments in the build-up, like I say, in the sort of 12-18 months before. And then I think just I was probably a little bit physically overcooked by the time I got there, and sort of, you know, an elite athlete is a highly finely tuned instrument. And I think that just in all the prep and all the stuff we were doing at the High Performance Center in Pretoria, and that, you know, we had quite a big squad there, and Revs was coaching us, and he was using me. I used to sort of, I was the fittest guy on the team at the time, and I think he was using me to try and set the bar for the next generation of players who were in camp with us, because, you know, you're going to have the likes of Clark and Nickel and Jackson and a couple others, Fulton, retiring after those games. And so I think in me pushing myself and Rebs pushing me as well, probably overcooked it a little bit. So I was a bit disappointed, but maybe had another year or two. You know, I was a fit guy, and I probably could have carried on a little bit, but I was getting, you know, in my life in general, probably started to need to get a life, get a job, that type of thing. Hockey wasn't paying the bills. So, yeah, I maybe retired a little bit too soon, but in retrospect, I don't really regret too much.
And Greg, obviously you moved from playing into coaching, and it wasn't a very a long gap between the end of your playing career and the start of your national coaching career.
Sure. I mean, I was an old bullet when I stopped playing, so I was 34. You know, and at that stage, like I say, just with the isolation years and having pretty much been in, well, you've been involved since the day dot off post-isolation. You know, I was as experienced a hockey person as anyone in this country in terms of what I'd experienced and what I knew and that type of thing. So I'm not saying that I was necessarily the best coach at the time, because I had a lot of I had a lot to learn as a coach. I'd player coached quite a lot in the back end of my career, but being a reasonably handy player at the time, international player coming into our domestic competitions, it was easy to dominate as a player. And I say easy to, sorry, I don't mean that arrogantly. and do the coaching role at the same time. And so, yeah, being a standalone coach, it is very different. And coaching at the top level is very different. Like you said, Gareth says there's a lot of admin and a lot of other stuff that goes into the day-to-day preparation and putting tours together and selecting teams and putting training camps together and having players based overseas and all that type of stuff. So, yeah, it took me a couple of years maybe to cut my teeth in that role.
Yeah, a lot of people actually mentioned the fact that when you become a coach, particularly of a national team, you're surprised by the amount of admin, as you said. And coaching almost takes a back seat to so many other chores and tasks that you have to deal with, and that becomes very tedious and tiresome along the way.
Yeah, I think, and particularly if you are trying to do a good job, like any good coach, I guess, worth his or her salt would, Yeah, I'm an extremely competitive person. I'd been an international player, so I knew what a good program kind of looked like. And I just wanted to try and create an environment for the players that they could just not deal with all the sort of off-field issues. I mean, finance is always the predominant one, but there's a lot of other stuff which, you don't want them spending energy on that. And so in trying to do that and not having heaps and heaps of other support, like, some other programs and some other sports have sort of high performance directors and this and that and loads of backroom staff and people in sort of national federation offices who do that. I think Gareth's experiencing the same thing. If you want it done, you've got to do it yourself. And if you want to try and put a decent program together, there's you have to be quite entrepreneurial, call in a lot of favors and think out of the box a lot. And that's sort of over and above just the amount of emails you've got to churn out and all the sort of real dog work you've got to do.
I've got to ask, you said towards the back end of your career, you doubled up as a player coach. What is it like? I've always been fascinated by people that are able to do both roles adequately.
Yeah, so, I player coached a couple of club teams from around about maybe 2000. I was pretty much player coaching most of the club teams that I was playing at, mainly down in Durban, for the likes of Technikon Natal, Maritzburg Collegians, those types of teams. I player coached a KwaZulu-Natal Raiders team to a national title back in probably 2002. So, yeah, like an IPT is not too... there's not that much to it. There's obviously the prep and the team. There's a panel of selectors that helped me select the team, and then the admin around it. A lot of the sort of association does all the sort of booking of hotels. I don't think there were any flights. I think the tournament was up in Maritzburg that year, and then the guys really know what an RPT is about. It's not too onerous, and I guess. Playing at the top level at that stage, I was playing some pretty good hockey at the time, so it was easy. I just had to go out and do what I did on the field, and I knew that my work rate and sort of all of my sort of vision and my philosophy about how the way we play the game, a lot of the guys already knew that. I played in a lot of teams with them, so I think if that's clear. Tactically, I was reasonably astute again at that level, at a provincial level. So it's just a case of getting everyone on the same page and not having to deal with any major calamities.
Do you think it would ever in our lifetimes, or do you think it would be possible to fill a similar role? And I'm not talking about you, I'm just saying anyone really. At the highest level, could that be done?
Yeah, I think, top sport has changed a lot in the last sort of 20 years. And I remember Shane Warne talking about it. But even now in our national team, I mean, guys like, I know guys like Austin and Tim Drummond and that type of thing, they've got so much experience and so much knowledge. I mean, the back end of my playing career, Giles was coaching, and I know he used to lean on the guys that were playing overseas and that type of thing. And, with players, if you look at cricket, the guys go and play in the IPL and they play here and they play there. They've got so much experience and knowledge that they bring that back into the team environment. Gary Kirsten's a perfect example. He's, he went to India and he said, what can I teach Sachin Tendulkar about batting?
Yeah.
You're just more there to guide the ship and to provide a structure for the players and an infrastructure. Yes, you have to lead culture and you have to make sure that everyone's living the sort of lifestyle and the parameters that you as a team want to live by. But really, in any modern sport, almost the players know as well as the coaches are. Well, there's generally a group of senior players who are doing it week in, week out in the top leagues, and they know it as well as you do. Maybe as a coach, you have the benefit of experience and saying, I've seen this before. I think we need to do it differently or whatever, even though they're saying this is the recognized tactic of the day.
Yeah, just by the sounds of things, it sounds as if you're fairly well read on the subject. Being a coach now, do you go out and seek guidance or look for mentors, so to speak? You mentioned the likes of Gary Kirsten. I mean, have you been going that route in terms of looking up or looking for new ways in which to expand your knowledge base?
Yeah, I mean, I always used to try and do it. I still do as much as possible. In a South African context, anytime there's, like Paddy Upton, for example, he's achieved in his own right as a coach, and he's very, very well versed now, and he's got some great accolades of his own. But obviously, when he went to with Gary to guide that Indian team, I came back and I remember sitting at Newlands with him whilst we watched a day of one of the test matches, and we just sat and we exchanged a few ideas and this and that. And yeah, I mean, I love trying to get together with people of those sort of caliber, someone who's got some great experiences or great knowledge to share, and just to be able to pick their brain and see. Sometimes you come out of that and you say, well, I knew 8 out of 10 things that I asked that guy, but there might be one or two things too that just sort of say, okay, well, I've been thinking about that myself. That's just confirmed that I need to do more of this and less of that, or whatever it might be. So yes, I do constantly try and seek people out. With Canada, I've been very fortunate. They've got some incredible support structures in terms of their Olympic committees and their national sports associations, and that lots of online stuff that you can go and just attend a webinar here, and also they do so a lot of coach development and post the World Cup. It's quite an interesting sort of online course which I did with a facilitator, and so those types of things are always valuable. I mean, any good coach worth their salt is constantly trying to learn and embed themselves and think of different ways of approaching a problem.
Greg, you bring up Canada, and obviously not long after the Olympics was formally postponed, the head coach there, Paul Bundy, stepped down. Yep. What does that mean for your position? Have you chatted with Hockey Canada, and what's happening going forward?
Yeah, so Field Hockey Canada, yeah, they've had a bit of a turbulent couple of years, sort of at administrative level, and I think with Paul, he's done an incredible job. I mean, I was very lucky when Paul gave me the call back in 2017, and he was. His daughter was born. Him and his partner had their first child in late September, beginning of October last year, just before our playoff against Ireland, where we ultimately qualified for Tokyo. And on a daily basis, he is having a lot of I wouldn't say fights with the administration, but he was expending a lot of energy trying to sort of keep this program on going, and having to sort of just constantly check them and that type of thing. And I think he was prepared to put the energy in to go till the end of Tokyo, as it were, in 2020. Once it got pushed out, I think he just said, I was going to step away after those games and spend time with my family. Another 15 months is no good. So that's his reasoning. And obviously I fall under his regime in that he brought me in. Now, the current staff, everyone's still together and keen to carry the program forward. Field Hockey Canada are currently doing a review of the entire men's program, I think possibly the women's program as well, and just the general domestic hockey. So kind of everyone's in limbo a little bit. The lockdown's come at a reasonably opportune time for that with Paul's resignation. So we all wait to see what the review comes back with. They've got a panel, a high performance advisory panel, and they'll be making recommendations post their review. So kind of, just at the moment. Just a little bit of wait and see for me at the moment.
But the time with the Canadian national team has obviously been quite a fruitful one. And of course, here in South Africa, we haven't enjoyed your time with the Canadian team that much. Because obviously Commonwealth Games, South Africa did beat Canada, but Canada finished higher up, finishing ahead of us in gold. But then, of course, there in India, the Hockey World Cup. I mean, how hard is that for you, Greg, to be on the other bench? I mean, you've basically been on the South African bench for almost 20 years of international hockey, of either playing or coaching. How hard is it to be on the opposite bench going against South Africa and obviously having a wonderful one-all draw for Canada that puts you guys through to the knockout stages?
Yeah, listen, it is incredibly difficult. Like you say, I mean, for pretty much half of my life, not quite, I was involved with the South African men's team, at first as a player, then as a coach. In between, for a short time, I was an assistant coach for one tour and a selector and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so it's incredibly difficult coming up against that team, which is, I've worn that badge so long and it's meant so much to me, and I've put a lot of blood, sweat and tears into that team. Again, I guess it comes down to it's a professional era. You're expected to go and put absolutely everything into the preparation to try and plot the downfall of the opposition team. Just because they have a pro tier on their chest shouldn't make any difference. So, yeah, it has been very difficult because a lot of those guys that I coached back in the day, the likes of the Aussies and the Timmy D's, Russi, it's still playing. So, yeah, there's a lot of shared experiences that we've had. And obviously, quite strangely, I had quite an acrimonious relationship with Canada when I was playing and when I was coaching. we used to love to hate each other. So I was quite surprised when I got the call from them. But, there's a lot of similarities to their program, to South Africa, in that it is, a smaller sport, considered a smaller sport in their country. We sort of similar ranking, we fit into a similar bracket in terms of the rankings, so it's a very similar culture and a similar mindset. So from that point of view, it's quite easy to sort of fit into that mold. But yeah, it's incredibly difficult coaching against South Africa, and fortunately or unfortunately, depends on which side of the fence you're sitting on. I still haven't beaten them yet.
I've got to jump in here, Ty. Is it a burden or a blessing being a coach of a sport in a country where another sport bearing the same name is a religion to the country?
No, I mean, so it's not, we talk about hockey here. They can't, if you talk about hockey there, then automatically you're talking about ice hockey.
Yeah.
Everything has to be qualified. It's field hockey. So yeah, it is a bit of a burden. Again, when I first went and started coaching the team and I interacted with Canadian people, I spoke about hockey and I had to, I'm going to say field hockey first before everything. But, yeah.
Greg, and obviously your international coaching career has also seen you go over to India and coach the junior India national team. And, of course, you also had a very good record at the currently defunct, still not sure what its progress is, Hockey India League. What was that experience like? Because for a while it felt like hockey finally had a product that could go somewhere before it died away.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly sad that it has fallen away. I mean, you've seen how popular the IPL cricket has been over the years and what a great product it is. And Hockey India, we're on something, a really good wicket there with the Hockey India League. I'm not sure the reasons. I know part of it was the sort of scheduling that the FIH had, and the president of the FIH being Narinder Batra, who was also the ex-Indian hockey president. Yeah, so there was a lot of, I don't know the real reason why it stopped happening. But I think world hockey is the poorer for it, because it was a great vehicle for the top players to go and earn some good cash to keep themselves professional sportsmen and not have to have sort of part-time work or whatever. It was a great product, I think, for an international audience. And certainly from an Indian cricket perspective, one of the reasons they developed the IPL was because they also wanted to expose a whole bunch of young up-and-coming cricketers of Indian nationality to all these superstars and sort of could pick their brain and play in these great competition. And that was exactly what the reasoning was for the Hockey India League as well. And it was, I mean, I was seeing that firsthand, how these young under 21 guys who I ended up coaching in the junior Indian team were sort of rubbing shoulders with the likes of Mo Forster and Ashley Jackson and Austin Smith and Justin Reed-Ross, and just at the beginning, how much in awe they were, and then just sort of, you know, really getting to know them and play and being comfortable playing at that level and being able to then plug that into a junior national team. So, India, I think I'm missing a trick on that one.
And obviously, you, as far as I remember, you did also get a winner's medal.
It was in year that we're in. It was the inaugural competition, 2013. I really scored a luck there. There were only five franchises. There were three Olympic gold medal winning coaches in Rick Charlesworth, Barry Dancer, and Roland Altmans. And then little old me and an Indian ex-national coach, Bhaskaran. And I kind of was thrown this gig. I was pretty fortunate. We had played India a couple of times in the build-up to the London Olympics. They were looking for opposition in the February of 2012, and I think I was sort of a little bit of a return of favour. We went and played a five-game series against India. They went on to qualify for that Olympics, and they got a look at the South African team, and at that stage, you know, we went on to qualify for the Olympics as well and do quite well. And I think they sort of saw me and my team and my coaching style and that type of thing, and perhaps having done it in India, maybe I did myself a couple of favors. I was asked to coach the Ranchi Rhinos, and we were just really lucky. Kind of everything fell into my lap. I was very fortunate to have a great leader in Mo Forster. I had Austin and Justin Reed-Ross as South African players who knew me well and could sort of, I don't know, help maybe smooth the way with the other international players behind the scenes on my behalf, if ever anything like that needed to happen. But I think the secret of our success for that tournament was the three teams that were coached by two Australians and a Dutch guy. Roland Altmans sort of loaded his team with Dutch guys, and the two Australian coaches loaded their teams with Australians. And we ended up in the auction getting one German, one Dutchman, one Spaniard, one New Zealander, one Australian, two South Africans, and an Englishman. And because there was no one definitive represented nation was South Africa, in fact, because Dave Staniforth was my video analyst / goalkeeping coach, and then there were two South African players. So there wasn't really any one overpowering sort of national setup, and no one gravitated towards that, and everyone sort of pulled their weight and really got stuck in, and we had a very harmonious team. So it was incredible. We went and we lifted the trophy, the first ever Hockey India League. Never forget that final in Ranchi. People were sitting on the roofs of blocks of flats overlooking the stadium, looking in. It was just an unbelievable atmosphere and a great, just such an amazing thing to be part of.
Yeah, Greg. So, I mean, if I ask you now, I mean, more than 100, I think it's 120 games as a national coach for South Africa. You've got a whole bunch for Canada, obviously as an assistant coach there. You've coached provincially, won RPTs, you coached Hockey India League. What is, I'm going to ask you, one playing highlight and one coaching highlight from your career?
Yeah, I mean, they just. I was actually thinking about it when I did that chat with Ian Evans a couple of weeks ago, and it was so difficult to narrow it down on one. I would imagine the goal I scored against Belgium in 2004 at the Olympic qualifier in Madrid, where there were 12 teams, you know, the likes of Spain and Holland and India, Pakistan, and we had to beat Belgium in the final game. It was for the 7th and 8th playoff to go to the Olympics, and there were sort of about 10 seconds left on the clock when I equalized to send the game into a shootout, and we won to send us to the Athens game. Yeah, I mean, it was just maybe because it was on the back end of my career. I wasn't an especially, out and out goal scorer, but it was just such a. I still remember it to this day. When the ball came, every single one of the Belgian players was ball watching, and mm-hmm. I sort of when I tried to trap this ball, which came to me quite briskly, it just sort of bobbled a little bit, and everything from my sort of 12 years of international playing. And domestic playing, just to sort of keep my head down, not rush the skill, just make sure that I made a really good contact and get a shot on target. Sort of, it was almost like playing it slow-mo in the moment. So that's something that really sticks out for me, but I'm sure there's a number of others. And yeah, I mean, coaching-wise, a lot of also some great moments that, Tyron, you asked me to put some footage together for you of that game in Japan, that final against Japan. It was amazing. Qualifying for an Olympic Games and doing it in such dramatic fashion as well. It was, we were really soaking a lot of pressure at the back end of that game. But when I won that Hockey India League, in front of a worldwide audience, as a South African hockey coach, where we had won a couple of tournaments along the way, and you win Africa Games, that type of thing, but really achieving on such a worldwide stage, and yes, I had some incredible players as well, but it was just a massive sort of weight seemed to have lifted off my shoulders, just in terms of my whole coaching career and I guess my playing career as well. That like finally, got a really big fish and managed to sort of win something pretty significant. So that maybe sticks out a little bit for me.
Greg, you said that you're very surprised when you got the call from Canada to join their ranks, but how long did it take for you to make the decision? Was it a no-brainer or did it take some convincing?
It took me very much by surprise. I went back to India to do a second year of the league in 2014, and I was pretty much fried. I'd been coaching at the top level for about 6-7 years, and I actually just needed a break to recharge my battery. And I just, as a head coach, you're constantly given energy. So I'd taken a bit of time out of the game. I was actually just started coaching domestically again. I've been coaching UCT for a season or two. I just wanted to keep my hand in it. It wasn't very onerous. It was just nice to keep ticking over. But in the January 2017, I took on a new role with Sachs High School. I just bumped into Giles Bonnet in Cape Town and went and did a consultancy with one of the provincial teams in China. So I was just starting to feel energy again to get more and more involved in coaching again. And out of the blue, I got this call from Paul Bundy. And Paul actually went to Jeppe High School until he was about 15 years old when his folks immigrated to Canada. Canada had come to Cape Town in January 2016 for a training camp in the build-up to Rio. And I knew their head coach at the time, Anthony Ferry, is an Aussie guy, and Paul was the assistant coach. And they were just looking for me to sort of just fill in a few gaps they had in their sort of logistics for that training camp, and I helped set them up at Bishop's as a training base and this and that. And we had a couple of coffees during their time here, because neither of them had been to an Olympic Games as a coach before, so they just wanted to pick my brain a bit. And yeah, I became quite fond of them. I got to know their players a bit because they had sort of asked me to watch some of their games and that type of thing. So yeah, I guess that's where Paul came from when he got the interim role. And yeah, very surprised, but yeah, I was glad to do it. They run an incredible program for the amount of players they have playing field hockey in the country. They rank 10 in the world. I don't think we can actually get any higher rank than that now with the Pro League, bar Field Hockey Canada coming up with $1 million to sort of enter the Pro League. So yeah, they really do fight above their weight, and it's been a really interesting program to be involved with.
Oh, okay. I'm pretty sure it must have been. And yeah, really, really glad to see that you've gone from strength to strength. Sad to have lost you to the Canadians. Hopefully you will find your way back from a professional capacity, of course not from a physical one, because as you said, you're speaking right now from your home in Cape Town. Ty, I think it's time that we head into our infamous one question quiz. I don't know if you've heard the show before, Greg, but simple, the name says it all. It's one question, and see if you can get it right or wrong. So I want to know from you, who is this person?
That Arnold Palmer, the late great Arnold Palmer, gave it in the day to get more of the guys to come over. And one of the greatest of all time, Tiger Woods, came over, and he covets his Open titles more than anything else. He loves his US Opens. He loves all his majors, as he should.
Who do you reckon that is?
Well, I was going to go with Lee Trevino at the beginning.
Yeah, I heard you shout that out.
But then there was a bit of a Scottish twang to the back end of that.
I'll play it once more. How about that?
Okay.
Here we go.
That Arnold Palmer, the late great Arnold Palmer, gave it in the day to get more of the guys to come over. And one of the greatest of all time, Tiger Woods, came over, and he covets his Open titles more than anything else. He loves his US Opens. He loves all his majors, as he should.
I'm going to give you Darren Clark.
Yeah, 100%. Well done.
Yeah.
You got him.
Darren Clark. There we go.
One of your namesakes. Another sporting Clark out there. There's plenty of you around.
Okay, wow. Well, in fact, Darren Clark's got a knee on the end of Clark. Clark doesn't have a knee on the end of Clark, but for just about the entire playing career that I played with a knee on the end on my back, because SA Hockey never seemed to read. Every time we got asked to fill in our bio data, and I used to write my Greg with two G's on the end of Greg and no E on the end of Clark, but funny, I always ended up with an E on the back.
And
Greg, that actually is
that's
mind blowing for me, because I thought your name had an E on it. Times I've watched hockey over the years, I thought there was an E.
It's a common mistake, and it happened a lot, and sort of, yeah, listen, I'm it's at first it's, it used to bug me, but I got over it a long time ago.
Let me actually have a look at this article that I'm reading. Good news. So the article that I've got here for fieldhockey.ca Canada, they've got it spot on. Double G, okay. No E.
No, and I've just gone back to look at my articles, and I spelled it right without the E, but obviously I copied and pasted back then, so I got away with
it. That's mind-blowing. So did you say, listen, I don't have an E, and they just ignored it each and every time?
Yeah, listen, probably doing them a bit of a disservice, but there were a couple of tours that I definitely had an E on the end of Clark and shouldn't have. So there was an administrative hiccup somewhere along the line, whether it was with SA Hockey passing on to SASCOC or to the national, the sporting body, who knows?
That's funny. Just talking about bios, etc., for Olympic Games, one of the awesome foursome, I forget who it was. Was it James Thompson? He was one of the rowers. Hey, Ty?
Yeah, correct.
I think this applied to him. So I was watching the race, and it was in, obviously, London 2012. And so the awesome foursome go on and win in dramatic fashion. So they get on top of the podium, and they're waiting for their medals. And the commentator's just buying time and just going through conversation. And he mentions that James Thompson is a male model by profession when he's not rowing. And I was fascinated. I'm looking at these four guys. No, it's not. They're not ugly, but I wouldn't have gone to say, "Hey, geez, that guy's a model," or any of the four. But anyways, I mean, obviously, what I've got to know about the world of modeling. And anyway, so I was just interested. And then I mentioned a couple of days later, I mentioned it to David O'Sullivan, who at the time was in London covering the event for 702. And he said, "Oh my God, you must actually hear the story." What happened was their coach, Roger Barrow, I think his name is.
Yes.
He was filling it out for them. And he said to the guys, "Listen, I need to fill this thing out." And they go, "Ugh, just write whatever." He said, "Okay, fine." So he had a field day making up their professions. And lo and behold, it gets onto TV at the moment they're about to get their gold.
There you go.
But, Greg, it's been fantastic chatting to you. And, best of luck for the remainder of the lockdown. And hopefully, we get back outdoors sooner rather than later, that you're able to continue your partnership with the Canadian hockey side.
Yeah, Derek, thanks very much. It's been awesome chatting. I really appreciate it. I'm really looking forward to getting outside again. And I really hope I can get to Tokyo as well, to also that it'd be an awesome event to be part of again.
Yeah, and we look forward to you not beating us in Tokyo.
I'll probably settle for a good one-all draw again.
Lovely stuff.
Greg, thanks so much, man, and keep safe for the remainder of the lockdown. And you know, as always, if you keep living your hockey life, we'll keep telling the story as much as we can.
Well, thanks, guys, and thanks for everything you do for hockey. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Greg. Cheers.
Cheers.
Ah, what a legend. I actually always say those words immediately after an interview, but it really does apply.
No, absolutely. I think it's, this is a man who's been to the Olympics four times, twice as a player, twice as a coach, and pending a fifth appearance pretty soon. So, let's see how it plays out. And hopefully he does get to take Canada, and hopefully they do lose to South Africa.
Yeah, let's certainly hold thumbs. But it's got another year to wait before that Olympics take shape, hopefully. And as I'm speaking to you now, we are in the midst of a announcement by President Cyril Ramaphosa. What is he saying? He says, looks like some activity will be allowed to resume from the 1st of May, but under specific conditions, health and safety protocols will be in place. So, yeah, it looks like a phasing out of the lockdown, so to speak. So that's good news on all fronts, particularly in the sporting world.
Yeah, of course. I mean, obviously, we can't wait to get people back on the fields and to start watching our hockey nation and our sporting nation back in action. But at the same time, we also know the importance of safety, and that comes first. We are very comfortable with that decision. And as long as that's the way they're going, we will keep supporting it.
Yeah, 100%. Don, thanks so much. Great guest, great co-host. And let's go to another one. What do you say?
Yes. We've got a really big name, as we always say, on the next one. So it's going to be a cracker.
Excellent. Ciao.
Cheers.